morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C. M23 rebels seek direct talks with President Felix Tshisekedi's government.
The M23, as you are aware of, has been withdrew for so many areas that it has ended, given for the full responsibility of the East African Regional Forces.
A leading human rights activist says the outcome of Nigeria's recent presidential election was not a true representation of the situation on the ground.
On February 25, 2023, the Nigerian people that had hitherto not believed in the electoral process of our country decided to come out and vote and take part in the electoral process. And they did vote. And unfortunately, their votes were stolen from them.
And the U.S. and the Chinese ambassadors to Zambia say their two nations will put their differences aside to help the Southern African country address its debt. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, a spokesperson for the M23 rebel group says militants will not disarm or demobilize until the group holds direct talks with President Felix Tshisekedi's government to resolve its concerns. The talks, Lawrence Kanyuka says, should be without preconditions aimed at ensuring the protection of residents in the part of the country it controls. He says President Tshisekedi's statement not to hold political dialogue with the rebel group does not inspire confidence that its concerns can be resolved. For more about calls for direct talks with the government, I reached Lawrence Kanyuka, the spokesperson for the M23 rebels.
On 4th of February, there was a communique released by the head of state who were in summit in Bujumbura, in Burundi, requested that there should be a ceasefire by all parties, the M23 to start withdrawing from some areas they have occupied. And these processes have to be accompanied by the political dialogue. This is what was decided. The M23, as you are aware of, has been withdrew for so many areas that it has ended, given for the full responsibility of the East African Regional Forces. Until today, there isn't any ceasefire by the DRC government.
People are questioning the reason why the M23 is not disarming according to the agreement. And then people are also saying that M23 is to blame for attacks on the civilian population. The report says it's M23 that is causing this problem, displacing a civilian population.
No. You see, you're a journalist, you know what I mean? You have to do the investigation and to actually say exactly what is happening or what is going on. So you can't just rely on a report which has conflicted with numbers. I think you're mentioning with Kishishe in your mind, where so many people are giving different numbers, including Human Rights Watch, who is talking about 20, and Amnesty International 20, and the DRC government saying 200 killed, and MONUSCO saying 121 killed, and as long as they haven't even done any investigation in the area. The M23 never signed any agreement. It was the decision of the leaders of the region. And the M23 comply, and even to say, we will actually implement this decision.
Are you therefore saying the M23 will not disarm or demobilize as long as you don't have a political direct dialogue with the President Tshisekedi's government?
We said Yes, we said, if there is not a dialogue, as this, President Tshisekedi said in a moment, there will be no dialogue, there will be just war. So why will we go to disarm while our people are being killed every single day?
No, but Lawrence, this is what a lot of people are saying, that your group is not a government. It is only the government that is mandated by the DRC constitution to protect the people.
I'll just remind people again, above anything, it's not only because it's the government that is allowed to protect the civilian. We are human above all. It's the right of every human right, every human citizen of this earth to protect one and another. We have seen it in 1994, where people are being killed by a government in Rwanda, committed genocide, supported by the Rwanda government, and the Rwanda government is the one who committed genocide. We have seen it in Germany.
Where do you go from here after President Tshisekedi's statement that he will not have a dialogue with the M23 rebel group? Where do you go from here? Does that mean that the conflict will continue?
But we are not responsible for the crisis in DRC. One should know that what you see in the east of Congo is just the tip of the iceberg. The M23 is not a problem. I said this many times. The M23 went to the exile in 2013. We had only less than 50 armed groups. 10 years after that, 2023, we have over 250 groups, armed groups, which means that the problem is there, is not actually the M23. The DRC government, the reason it doesn't want to talk to M23 is because the peace will come to the east of Congo. We deal with the root causes of conflict. Then it had to justify.
Lawrence Kanyuka is the spokesperson for the M23 rebels. He spoke with me from DRC. The International Financial Corporation, an international financial institution, has established a leading position as a promoter of private sector investment across Africa. Officials say the organization that offers investment, advisory, and asset management services has so far invested over $60 billion in business and financial institutions in Africa. For the latest development about IFC's priorities, especially regarding West and Central Africa, I reach Dalia Khalifa via Skype. She is the IFC's regional director for Nigeria, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Central African states.
IFC in Africa has a number of priorities, which I guess revolve around three main pillars. And one is to meet the infrastructure gap across the continent, but also to focus on the real sectors where we have a lot of possibilities for job creation. And then, of course, leading, you know, business approaches that are more inclusive and, you know, focus on priorities such as climate and gender. Those are really at the heart of what we do, you know, green solutions and making sure we have inclusivity across the economy.
Mm. So what would you say is the impact of IFC's investment in Nigeria and Central Africa?
Over the years, we have, last year, for example, we hit a record year of $9.5 billion almost in investments and financing across the region. And we're expecting that in this year, we're going to grow that even further. We want to grow it further because even though the continent has experienced a little bit of a deceleration in its growth numbers to about 3.9% in 2022 from 4.2% in the previous year, due to, you know, the Ukraine, the COVID, you know, all the issues that we know countries are suffering from at the global level, of course, have also hit Africa. And therefore, we need to move in even more strongly. So even though we hit a record year last year, we're expecting to expand that even further to focus on areas, like I said, beyond the three pillars. You know, if we delve a little bit further, what do we mean in those three pillars? Regional integration, trade, trade both inter and intra-trade, digitization so that the continent can leapfrog a lot of the issues and even improve, whether it's from financial inclusion, access to markets, etc. And of course, you know, much of the continent, countries are urbanizing very quickly. So how can we do that in a green and sustainable way? And, you know, make sure that we have solutions for businesses that are green solutions so that they can both adapt and mitigate the effects of climate change.
All right. So, Dalia, you spoke about integration and trade. What do you think can be done to boost trade in West Africa and particularly in the CEMAC region, Central Africa region that you spoke about?
So, you know, trade is, it's a fun, so thus far in Africa, we've had a lot of trade, which is primary good trade, right? Countries are exporting primary goods, mostly to most advanced countries, and then importing back ready-made goods. So to have higher value. So improve your value chains, improve the value adds in products and productivity and in production manufacturing in the country so that when you export, whether it's regionally or internationally, you're exporting higher value goods. And of course, to do that, as I was mentioning before, you need to focus on things such as digitization, transportation, access to markets. Your infrastructure needs to be much stronger and capable of meeting those challenges. And IFC has focused a lot on making sure that our the trade and the capacity and the funding that we have for trade can meet those challenges. So, for example, we have put in place funding and financing capacities, whether it's the Global Trade Finance Program, which has about $16 billion to support trade finance, but also the African Trade and Supply Chain Finance Program, which is an additional $1 billion. And these are kinds of things that provide the trade financing that is needed to improve intra and international trade in Africa.
Talk to me about advancing gender inclusion in all of this.
Addressing gender equity, it's not just a moral imperative, it's actually smart business. And I can name study after study after study that has shown that the more you bring women into both as employers and employees into the private sector and into businesses, the bottom line benefits. And of course, in the more you have income earners in a household, the household benefits. So I don't think I need to make that argument anymore. The question then is, how do we do it in an effective and meaningful way? And so we always look when we are working with our private sector partners to make sure that they have the clear gender lens to what they're doing in terms of even when we're talking about representation on their boards. So we have a number of programs where we work with companies to improve board representation of women, which have shown to have a positive impact on profits. So because it doesn't make sense at all to leave 50% of your population out in the cold.
Dalia Khalifa is the IFC's regional director for Nigeria, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Central African States. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. via Skype. A leading human rights activist says the outcome of Nigeria's recent presidential election was not a true representation of what occurred on the ground. Citing voter irregularities and rigging during the February 25th general election, Aisha Yusufu, a supporter of former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi of the Labour Party, contends that the Supreme Court must rule on giving the mandate of the people to the rightful winner. Opposition candidates, including Peter Obi and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, are challenging the outcome of the election before the judiciary. For more about the court challenge and the latest on the political development in Nigeria, I had a sit-down with Aisha Yusufu here in the VOA studios in Washington.
What I mean by my statement is very simple. On February 25th, 2023, the Nigerian people that had hitherto not believed in the electoral process of our country decided to come out and vote and take part in the electoral process. And they did vote. And unfortunately, their votes were stolen from them. Their votes were changed. And so that's what I mean when I say that the mandate of the people must be given to the person that the people chose. That's where I'm going to. You have a situation where people went to their polling units and they voted. And after voting, the results were counted openly and the figures were entered. And people took pictures of those results. And also there was video recording by a lot of people of those results. And then you go on, when INEC came to announce those results, the results had been tampered with. They had been changed. Some of them, correcting fluid had actually been used, just as if, you know, kids playing with papers, be used to change results. And so what the INEC has declared for Bola Ahmed Tinubu, it's not the legitimate votes of the people. And so you cannot win if you don't have the highest number of legitimate votes. When you come and then results are rigged in your favor and results are put in your favor, that's not legitimate votes. And so that's what I'm talking about. And I'm saying that what the Bola Ahmed Tinubu has right now is the INEC's mandate. It's not the people's mandate. The people's mandate is that the results that when they went there, that they voted for, the results that were counted, that were supposed to be uploaded electronically, that couldn't be uploaded, that's the people's mandate we're asking.
You know, some APC officials told me that the BVAS used, or technology deployed by INEC, weeded out a lot of double voting or multiple voting, and that accounted for the small number of people, less than half of the 87 million people accredited or who registered to vote, who got their PVC to vote, and that the election results as announced by INEC was legitimate. Why do you differ?
The BVAS, there's no issue about the BVAS verifying people. That happened well. That's good. Where the problem came from was now uploading the result electronically. INEC on its own had decided that they were going to upload the result. The law had given them the opportunity to do that. This is something in the new electoral act that was not there before. And when last year, around November, people began to say there was something fishy that was going on, that INEC might not be uploading this result, the chairman himself came out categorically and called it fake news and said that they were going to do that. Then we came to, on the day of the election, you found a situation whereby results for House of Reps, results for a Senate, they were being uploaded, but when it came to result for presidential election, it wasn't being uploaded, because this would have cut out everything. We are supposed to see those results real time from all over the country. We know most of the rigging that normally happens in Nigerian election is done at the collation center. After voting, people have gone on, then they'll go and change the result. And so this was supposed to stop it. INEC didn't go with that. And what we now have, and even what was even uploaded some 72 hours, some weeks after the result had been announced, and then someone had been given the INEC mandate, was when they started uploading. Even as I speak right now, no, it's not yet 100% that had been uploaded. And what had happened was that there was a lot of changing of the results, using TIPEX to correcting fluid to change the result of Labour Party and then add it to that of APC.
But the Information Minister is on record to have said that this was the most legitimate election, the most transparent, the most credible, and even less violent than previous elections in Nigeria, and that President Muhammadu Buhari's promise to ensure that his legacy, he leaves Nigeria with free, fair, transparent, and credible elections, has been upheld, and that he kept his promises.
If someone comes to your house and they were able to get into your house and they stole your things, and for them it was the easiest robbery that they had, does that still not make it a robbery? Of course, the perpetrator will always have something. I think it was Chinua Achebe that said that as long as the story of the hunting is being told by the hunter and not by the lie, it will continue to glorify the hunter and not the animals themselves. And so when you have the perpetrator coming out to speak, what else do you expect him to come and say? To admit that, yes, they did rig. But the evidence are there. And this is something they did openly. They were not hiding. The presidential candidate of the APC came out to say that power is not served in a restaurant, it's not served a la carte, people should grab it, hold it, and all sorts of things. They came out to threaten people that they were not going to allow people to vote. And the police that is supposed to maintain law and order came out to say that he was joking.
Aisha Yusufu is a rights activist and supporter of Nigerian presidential candidate Peter Obi. She spoke with me from here in Washington. VOA.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
The U.S. and the Chinese ambassadors to Zambia say their two nations will put aside their differences to help the Southern African country address its $14 billion debt. Analysts say its debt is unsustainable and is making the country unattractive to local and foreign investors. Meanwhile, the government led by Finance Minister Dr. Setumbeko Mosokotwani is in talks with World Bank and IMF officials on restructuring the debt. Mosokotwani is currently in Washington for talks with the two institutions during their annual ongoing meetings in Washington. I sat down with the minister and asked him about Zambia's economic outlook and the prospects for the talks. Here is the conclusion of the conversation with the Zambian finance minister.
But do you have the mechanisms and the measures in place? So if these private businesses and organizations invest in Zambia, their investments will be protected.
The measures that you are talking about, they are not just good for foreign investors. They are also good for local investors. Because local investors also sometimes suffer from judiciary that is slow, takes a lot of time to make judgments, commercial disputes are not properly handled. That is not good for any businesses, local or foreign. I think the important point is that we cannot create a heaven in one day or 2 days. This is a process that we have to get started, push very, very hard. The investors out there are aware that the world is not perfect. But once they see that you are making genuine efforts consistently to bring about an environment that is conducive, they will take the risk. Okay? They will take the risk.
Is there a political will to actualize this in Zambia?
In Zambia, yes, there's a big political will to do these things. But again, let's not wait until everything is perfect. My view is that whichever country is ready to get started, let them get started. Already you can see a country like Mauritius. Mauritius is not what it was in the 1960s. It is transformed. So we are learning from that. We are also learning from other countries within Africa that seem to be transforming. And when that happens, you learn a lot from what your neighbor is doing. And I'm sure many people will copy, whether it is Zambia, whether it is Mauritius, we shall all going to learn from each other and move forward.
Mr. Finance Minister, I understand there is a staff agreement between the IMF and Zambia about revenue generation and, you know, subsidy removal to ensure that Zambia is more on a sound footing. Some people have expressed concern that some of these conditionalities might negatively impact on the Zambian people, especially those youth you talked about who don't have jobs. It will create a little bit of a challenge. How do you intend to handle this? Because that could be a challenge for the economy.
Yeah, I think many people want to talk about an IMF program,
right,
from the perspective of what used to happen in the 1970s, 1980s. But that is no longer the case, because the IMF itself, I think it has been going through a process of transformation. It is indeed true that in undertaking economic reforms, we've had to make some changes. And these changes have been initiated by the Zambian government, supported, of course, by the IMF, but it has not been an imposition. It is something that we ourselves felt is something that needed to be done. Let's take the example of removal of subsidies. The subsidy that has been removed is the subsidy on fuel, because we used to spend something like $500 million in the past subsidizing the price of fuel. At the time when we were doing that, at the time when government was subsidizing people driving cars, who generally tend to be slightly better off compared to, yes, there's poverty everywhere, but he who owns a car is normally slightly better off compared to the average person. At the time when we were subsidizing the fuel, millions of children could not go to school because their parents were not unable to pay school fees. Their parents were unable to put them in boarding. We did not have enough teachers. At most schools, maybe you had only one-third of the required number of teachers. We did not have sufficient health center facilities. We even were walking 30 kilometers to get to the nearest health center, even for delivery. So we said to ourselves, surely it is better to take this money that we are subsidizing on fuel so that we can send all the children to school, so that we can hire more teachers, so that we can build more clinics. So yes, money was moved from fuel, but the same amount of money was taken back to society to do things that we thought were more valuable for the country, sending children to school, building more clinics, hiring teachers. So the hardships that you talk about, yes, you can say that those who drive now face hardships, but I think the beneficiaries are more, and also the quality of where the money is being spent, in our view, is more important.
Dr. Situmbeko Mosokotwane is Zambia's finance minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. A Zimbabwean actress battling cancer has asked wealthy citizens to buy a radiotherapy machine for government hospitals because she says the country's only unit has stopped working. As Colombo's Mavunga reports for VOA from Harare, many blame Zimbabwe's higher mortality rate among cancer patients on the country's poor state of healthcare.
Tinopona Tintin Katsande, a Zimbabwean actress, says she's almost done with her treatment for cervical cancer at a private hospital. She says the government hospitals had no working radiotherapy machines, so her family helped raise money for radiation therapy at a private hospital. Katsande says she has met other cancer patients who have not been so lucky.
My peers that I have met in support groups, just last, when I penned that, I lost six women with such potential and with such vibe and with such power that had been taken down, through cervical cancer, particularly even, because treatment cannot be completed without the service of the radiotherapy.
Jennifer Juliet Mugonda from Kadoma, a mining town about a two-hour drive southwest of Harare, has cancer too. She says doctors at a local government hospital asked her to stop going there and seek help at a private hospital about 400 kilometers away near Zimbabwe's border with Mozambique. She has not been treated for cancer for about 3 years now. She fears for the worst.
I am still surviving, but I know where I am going. Cancer kills. So I am finished. So what I know is my failure to get treatment is leading to my death.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Health did not confirm or deny claims that government hospitals have no working radiotherapy machines and declined VOA's request for further comment. Katsande is asking the country's wealthy citizens to help people like Mugonda.
Some way, somehow, we've got to come together to buy at least one radiotherapy machine. You cannot holistically treat cancer without a full treatment, and one important part of it is the radiotherapy. Without the machine, that cannot be done.
According to Zimbabwe's latest figures, the number of new cancer cases more than doubled to 7,800 from 2009 to 2019. The Zimbabwe Cancer Registry says about 85% of cancer patients delay treatment until it's too late.
The cost of treatment is high, and also the knowledge among the population is very limited. Cancer knowledge is very limited, so a lot of people are likely to delay to be diagnosed of the disease.
Meanwhile, Jennifer Juliet Mugonda is trying to raise money so that she can finally get the medication and treatment she needs at a distant private hospital. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, Sudan's military and a powerful paramilitary force battled fiercely Saturday in the capital and other areas, dealing a new blow to hopes for a transition to democracy and raising fears of a wider conflict. Doctors' groups reported at least 27 dead and 180 wounded, with the toll expected to rise. The clashes capped months of heightened tensions between the military and its partner-turned-rival, the Rapid Support Forces Group, or RSF. Those tensions had delayed a deal with political parties to get the country back to its short-lived transition to democracy, which was derailed by an October 2021 military coup. Chaotic scenes unfolded in the capital of Khartoum, where fighters firing from truck-mounted machine guns battled in densely populated neighborhoods. By the end of the day, the military issued a statement ruling out negotiations with the RSF, instead calling for the dismantling of what it called a rebellious militia. The head of the paramilitary group, in turn, branded the armed forces chief a criminal. The tough language signaled that the conflict between the former allies, who jointly orchestrated the 2021 coup, was likely to continue. Meanwhile, diplomatic pressure appeared to be mounting. Top diplomats, including the U.S. Secretary of State, the UN Secretary General, the EU Foreign Policy Chief, the head of the Arab League, and the head of the African Union Commission, urged the sides to stop fighting. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Ahead of the knockout phase of the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederations Cup, the continental governing body is organizing an elite referees course in Cairo to equip referees ahead of the crucial weekends. The course will have 70 participants, comprising of 25 referees, 30 assistant referees, 5 video assistant referees, 5 instructors, and 2 VAR technicians. The program, which extends over 5 days, will end on Tuesday, the 18th of April, and will see the training focus on sharpening the skills of match officials, with special emphasis on incidents in the penalty area, offside position, game management, tactical fouls, and handball. This will be coupled with more practical teaching on positioning and reading of the game, VAR sessions, and training on the pitch with simulations. In swimming news, South African Olympian Roland Schoeman bagged second place in the 50 meters freestyle at the National Aquatics Championships on Saturday night in South Africa. After a seven-year hiatus from national contention, four-time South African Olympian Roland Schoeman was thrilled to be back in the pool as he finished behind Peter Kodzi, who is 24 years younger than him, with a time of 22.89 seconds. The 42-year-old by that timing qualifies for the World Championships. He describes his performance as exciting and owed it to discipline in and out of the pool.
You know, you're always in a race with seven other people, so it's rare that you look at age. You're just racing. So I was trying to get from point A to point B as quick as you can. But he's incredibly talented. You know, he's a big kid. Sprints well, 100's amazing, 200's good. So it's just special to be able to hop on the blocks and be, you know, having been gone for so long, and to be back and to be able to be competitive at this level is really special. Oh gosh, I work out every single day. I eat well. I stay away from junk food. I surround myself with really special people and try not to bring myself down at any point in time. And I think that really counts a lot.
In athletics, world record holder and current world champion in the 100 meters hurdles, Nigerian Toby Amusan, opened her 2023 outdoor season with a 12.59 seconds effort to finish second in the finals of the Tom Jones Memorial Invitational at the Percy Beard Track in Gainesville on Saturday. Nia Ali of the United States won the race with a time of 12.53 seconds to pick up the gold medal. 2022 World Indoor Champion Divine Charlton of Bahamas completed the top three after running a time of 12.64 seconds to finish third. Saturday's meet was Amusan's second competitive appearance since she successfully defended her Diamond League 100 meters hurdle title in September 2022 with a meeting record of 12.29 seconds. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
Would you like to be famous? Calling us on WhatsApp may gain you fame if we play your message on the radio. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. Here's that number again. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one month's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At the commencement of Russia's war in Ukraine, the Western powers imposed unprecedented sweeping sanctions against Russia aimed at limiting Russia's power to continue the war. Regrettably, these sweeping sanctions have been having an unknown consequences for many in the global South, particularly as they may relate to the applying of sanctions on the SWIFT system, which for many decades have remained reliable to them, as well as freezing the assets of friends of Putin and freezing Russia financial assets in Western banks. These developments have rattled many of the leaders in the global South because it introduces certain unpredictability in payment for international trade. As such, they were scrambling to find alternate means to the dollar to reduce their vulnerability. And many in the global South have already signed or reached understanding on the use of the national currency for international trade, particularly India, Russia, China have done so. The question for the rest of the global South is, what do they do? In the twisted of Brazilian president, Lula da Silva, he spoke extensively on this matter. He is urging states in the global south to do what he calls de-dollarization in their transaction for foreign trade. And as an example of these 15 agreements signed between Brazil and China, one is dedicated to an agreement whereby China and Brazil will use their national currency for trade between them. The issue for other African states might be more complicated because de-dollarization will take a very long time and may be very cumbersome for African states on three grounds. First, many African currencies are very weak. Two, a number of Francophone states already have links with the euro. And for the rest, it is regrettable that many African states have already allowed their countries to be dollarized, even for small transactions. So it will be a major uphill fight for Africa. Last week, Kenyans were surprised when President Ruto announced that henceforth Kenya will be able to purchase oil and gas from some Gulf state by the use of Kenyan shillings. Despite the difficulties facing Africans, it is prudent for many of them to start looking at the implication of the continuing process of de-dollarization in international trade. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Still your girlfriend, 'cause the girl them call me that you, yeah. When I come through, hide your girlfriend, 'cause I'm still your girlfriend, 'cause the girls them call me that you, yeah. Bad girl come wine to the baseline. Anybody bad pass you be fake high. Me I want to deal with you, me I want to roll with you, boy. Where you are, where you are, where you are. Take your time, take your time, take your time. 1+1 be 2, so big we do the do. Oh, yeah.
All the girls, oh, all the girls, oh. Take it down, oh, take it down, oh.
Fiesta.
All the girls, oh.
My name is Divine Tembengba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clote. Stay tuned and don't change that dial.
I enter from my butcher, go kwakwa lata. Money mota kasu face ya wata. I know fit for some if it don't pass my power. I roll up a shawarma, I get for kwakwa lata. I enter from my butcher, go kwakwa lata. Money mota kasu face ya wata. Pass my power. I roll up my shawarma. I dey for kwakwa lata.
Nyofo, Olana, on God. Ile ni let me ask God. I dey fly me, unja mashami, me no way I jam. Wahabi, I look, mukada muva. Can't you see? Love over do. Unja maribi, I come and leja. Love this song, tomorrow shall love me. You is a cry. Baby, don't you waste my time. That's my good song.
About VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
Success will never come to you.
No.
Work and do what you gotta do.
Do what you got to do. Yeah.
Nobody really cares.
Nobody
success will never come to you.
No.
Work and do what you gotta do.
Do what you got to do. Yeah.
Nobody really cares.
One God.
Digital Mukatel and
Zimbabwe.
Ability extension. Pablo, coming to you from another. If you're making money, nobody hear what people say. Tell them don't block my way. Ah, yeah. Them used to think I'm funny when man hustle and hunt for me, but them want to see me dead.
Who God bless, no one curse, can't touch my
dollar to a milli. Don't despise, won't end up in the well. Dog, I remember, kudara kwangu, patina kanawani. Chai batika, well. Tanaka bata, ajik very fast. Now I pray it lasts, and that is forever. I'm working, and I'm shaking. No great things, me anticipating. Too much thing I praise him for this and other blessing. So I tell him it's worldwide.
Will never come to you. Work and do what you gotta do. Obey your usife. Nobody really cares. Success will never come to you. Work and do what you gotta do. Obey your usife. Ain't nobody really cares. If you're making money, nobody hear what people say. Tell them don't block my way.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, bad behavior reflects one's background. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.